right? I want to talk about how the supermassive black holes are related to the galaxy. And part of the goal here is to understand a connection between the galaxy and the black hole. I'm going to divide the talk into three groups. So I'll talk about the quiescent galaxies. And so these are mainly in our mid-range black holes, supermassive black holes. And most of that is part of the Nurka group. To understand anything about the possible connection between the galaxy and the black hole, an important thing to do is to study the extremes of black hole masses. So there are two other spectrums I want to talk about, and the one is the very small, and by small I mean globular cluster scales. And this is an extension of my thesis work and at Rutgers, and that was mainly with Tad Pryor and Ted Williams. But now we have some new results from Space Telescope on M15 and a possible black hole in M15. We just got the data done last week, so I don't have a model yet, but all this is work with in collaboration with Van der Marl and Joris Garrison at the Space Telescope. And then I'll do an extension of what Laura just talked about and on the very large and trying to use black hole masses in quasars. And all this is work mainly with Craig Shields and Bev Wills. So these are my new Texan co-patriots, so don't mess with us. Okay, now the current census of black hole mass, let me just pick up a recent table of black hole masses. And so this is a paper by Scott Tremaine that was just accepted. We haven't put it on AstroPH yet. And I'm just going to show a table here. There are gas masses, measurements of black holes from gas masses and measurements from stars in this plot. A point I want to stress here is that I'm going to talk about correlations having to do on these galaxies, and one person's mass may not be another person's favorite mass, and one person's table of galaxies is not going to be someone else's table of galaxies of what a positive black hole detection is. Here are the galaxies that I believe, Tremaine and our group believe, and it's about 35 or so galaxies now. And this sample is going to grow quite a bit. These masses have been in a state of flux for a while. And when a person measures a mass, someone else takes the same data, you can get a very different mass. And particularly, I just mentioned IC1459, which just is on the bottom here, just changed by a factor of 10, being measured by the same group. Tim DeZayu and Verdell Klein had a gas mass, and now they have a stellar mass, and that's a factor of 10 difference. I'll talk about that in a moment as well. There are a variety of ways to measure black hole masses, and I'm not going to go through them, just to stick this plot up here for a moment. What I mainly want to talk about today are measuring black hole masses from stars, and I'll mention gas. And Laura just talked about the reverberation techniques, and she also mentioned photoionization models. What's nice about the photoionization and the reverberation models is that you're going to be able to apply it to a very large sample of galaxies, and possibly out to very large redshift. If you believe these photoionization models, where all you need to measure is the luminosity, we should be able to apply this out to any distant quasar. I'm going to talk about stars for just a moment and how I measure black hole masses from stars. You have to run a dynamical model. What you get if you model black holes from stars is you get the black hole mass, but you also get the orbital distribution of the stars in the galaxy. And I want to stress that this is going to be a relatively new area where we learn about what is going on inside the galaxy and how the black hole affects the stars in the galaxy. So it's an evolutionary effect. So just briefly, let me stick up how we make a model of a galaxy. And we're going to make the most general model that we have, and that's a three-integral model. So it's an axisymmetric three-integral model where we allow a star in an axisymmetric system to orbit in any fashion it wants. We have no assumptions that we put in about the distribution function. The only way to do that is to do it through an orbit-based code through Schwarzschild modeling, where you build the galaxy up star by star, you run the orbits in there, and then you fit to your data. So you observe the surface brightness implies a luminosity density implies a mass density plus a black hole and a halo, if you like, implies a potential, and you run orbits in that potential trying to cover the appropriate phase space. And then you match those, and then you have to measure a linear set of orbital weights, and to your data. So just to give you a schematic of how it's done, here I have Z in the galaxy and R in the galaxy. It's axis symmetric. Each color here is a star that it's a particular orbit that, and I'm following that orbit as through this potential. Here's this is the potential for the galaxy 3379. This is a particular model where I've added a black hole in, and you run that orbit in that potential. So what is special about this, just to show you the influence of the third integral, is that each star here has the same energy and angular momentum. Each different color, same angular, the same energy and angular momentum. The only thing I've changed is the third integral. The third integral, all you simply have to do is to change the drop point. So here I show you about seven or eight orbits. We run typically between 5,000 and 10,000 of these, and then we simply ask, okay, how much light is in a particular area? Compare that to your data, both in the total light and in velocities. And you get a best fit to your data. And then you change your black hole mass, you do the whole thing again, you run a whole bunch more orbits, and you see how much better it fits in your model. You end up with is chi-squared contours. Here are seven galaxies that I've run. What you have here is black hole mass, the input black hole mass on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis you have the mass to light. And what you see is each point here is a model that I've run. And that model has a chi-squared associated to it, and these are contours of chi-squared. And this is 68%, 90, 95, and 99% contour levels. Each point, each galaxy here that we've modeled, this is based on HOT data, has required a black hole. Just to give you a sense of the computation involved here, each point on this plot here takes approximately a day or two of CPU on a fast computer. And there are many, many more points outside of this range here that haven't been plotted. I'm going to zoom in on this plot. So it's a significant amount of computer time that has gone into this. It's a very expensive code. Okay, so you get your black hole mass and you say, so what? Let's see. So what can we do with that? You plot everything against everything, and you try to find correlations. And we've looked for many types of correlations. I only have so many parables here. To read this plot is fairly easy. If you wanna look at the size of the galaxy as a function of black hole mass, that's this plot here. And you just try to find correlations, and you say, look, this is kind of nice. Let's take a look at that. So let me just concentrate on the black hole sigma just for a moment here. Here I'm going to plot black hole, and Laura showed some of these plots, black hole sigma and mass and bulbs. Here is the black hole mass against the luminosity, the mass, and the sigma. There have been claims in the literature, and now Laura has an additional plot of dark halo that shows a tight correlation in mass, for example. And Juan Dell has been working on this, and McClure and Dunlop as well. They suggest that the mass correlation is better than the sigma correlation. I don't see that yet, and it'd be nice to get a very large sample to compare with the dark halo profile. But for now, I'm gonna go on the sigma correlation. What's nice is that each color here corresponds to a different technique to measure the black hole mass, and they tend to give the same normalization. So we're not too concerned about biases in the technique. So let me talk about the black hole sigma for a moment. because there's been some debate in the literature about the slope of the correlation. And just let me say that very briefly what I believe is going on. Here is a black hole and Tegma. And the slope has ranged from 3.7 to 4.8. And there's been various concerns as to what is going on here, and you know there's concerns about the uncertainties in the x and the y direction on this plot, concerns about the sample selection and the resolution limit and such. Now, a difference between 3.7 and 4.7 may not seem like a lot, and it may not be that important, but just to show you why it probably is important, and let me show you just here's this a sample of models and what the slope of the correlation has come out of these theoretical models. And I'm only showing you a small sample of here, and there are many. I made this plot about a year ago, and I got tired of making more plots and adding on to it because it really is up to at least a dozen by now. And the value of the slope will change quite a bit. But let me tell you what we think is going on. This is, I heard this about 2 months ago that it may be a typo. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. So let's take that one out of there because it was kind of off scale here with everything else. But I said it might be. It's not going to be quite. It's 3.92. It's 3.92. That's good. It must be right then. Okay. It's a detail here, but it's a rather interesting detail, and it taught us something about galaxies. The difference, we believe, now Scott Tremain worked quite hard on this, trying to figure out what this difference actually was. And we spent quite a bit of time, and we think we understand it now. It's due to a variety of techniques, but what's causing about 70%, 80% of the variation is the fact that you're comparing an extrapolated Tegma measurement, what had been done. Here I'm using Tegma inside an aperture radius, and as opposed to Tegma at RE over 8. And when you measure Tegma at RE over 8, what you typically do is you take a Tegma knot, just a central Tegma measurement, and you extrapolate to a Tegma at RE over 8. Now, it's an actual measurement of the data. You just take the data and you make that measurement. Now, we know that the galaxies have a variety of profile types in the middle. So when you go from a central Tegma measurement to a Tegma at RE over 8, what had traditionally been done is you use a divocular profile and you find out how that extrapolation is supposed to go. However, galaxies are not similar in terms of their luminosity profile. So you can't make that simple correction from Tegma naught to Tegma at RE over 8. If it was random, you'd get scatter, but it turns out that the galaxies that are these core galaxies, these really big galaxies, have high Tegma. The ones that are parallel galaxies have very low Tegma. So that will put a bias, it puts a bias into the correlation if you use an extrapolated Tegma at RE over 8. Yes. Please.
I agree with everything you said. On the other hand, as you talked about the topic, as you heard from 2001, the dot with Sigma power, quote unquote, Sigma over 8, they are identical, 1 to 1. So clearly, I don't think you're handling it at work.
Yeah, and okay, well, we'll have to check that. We have the similar plot in our paper too. So we'll have to compare notes. Okay. Another point I want to mention here is gas kinematical measurements. Now these are done in green here, and so this point here is IC 1459. Before it was down here, it was a factor of 10 low. It was a factor of 10 below, and now it brings it up close to the correlation value. This brings into a concern about gas dynamics, and so there was a one galaxy there, and let me show you NGC 3379. Here is a H-alpha image of 3379. I have There's similar data on 3279 in terms of gas and stars, and the mass you imply from gas is about a factor of 10 below the mass you get from stars as well. And there are two other galaxies that show similar properties. So there is a concern here about many of the masses, the uncertainty both on the gas masses and the uncertainties on the stellar masses are probably larger than what we would like to think. So it's what is remarkable, though, and I have to stress it over and over, what is remarkable is even though you have uncertainty on these black hole masses and in this Higma, this scatter is so small. Anyway, okay, so our goal now is we want to push down to very small masses and we want to push to very large masses, just like Laura showed previously. And so let me show you some of those results there. And I want to switch to globular clusters because they are in an extrapolation down to the lowest possible down here in terms of globular clusters. So let me show you that. So for the globular clusters, if you want to measure black hole masses, it's pretty tricky because you have individual stars as opposed to just integrated light. What you need are large samples of stars. So I did a lot of this in my thesis work at Barker's, and we have a large samples of radial velocities for these globular clusters, for stars and globular clusters. And we concentrated on the central kinematics. We used the Fabry-Perot. Don't need to explain the Fabry-Perot technique, but it's very efficient at looking at a high density region. So we have maybe 25 or so in the end. I don't even have them all up here. Globular clusters. What you want to do is you want to look close to the center, and the one thing I want to highlight is the rotation that we see in these globular clusters near the center. Here is just a plot of rotation for one galaxy. This is 5824. To plot rotation, it's a little tricky. What you have to do is to plot the velocity offset as a function of azimuth on the sky, and you look for a rotation signature that, you know, if you have a solid body rotation, it would be a sine curve. Okay, and so what you do is you plot this as a function of radius. So you look for the velocity difference for a sinusoid variation as a function of position angle, as a function of distance. And if I show you M15, which is the highest density globular cluster, so this is the central kinematics in M15, so this is inside the central 4 arc seconds, there appears to be a rotation signature, and I've modeled this to death in terms of statistics. It's about a 3 sigma rotation amplitude here, and I've looked quite hard at if it can just be a noise, because now when you try to measure a rotation amplitude, anything, any kind of noise is going to boost you away from zero. Because you're bounded by zero, you're going to be boosted away from zero. Right. So, yes.
How sensitive would this be to central points?
It's not in M15, not at all, because the center is known to a few tenths of an arc second, and here I'm inside of 3.5 arc seconds. But for other clusters, it is an issue. You have to be careful about that. Okay, so what you do then here is, this implies that via the central sigma per M15 is about 11 or 12. The amplitude of the rotation is about 10 here. The via sigma is close to 1, extremely high in the center of a cluster. So now I've done this for all the clusters, and let me show you my most confusing plot that I've ever made. Here you go. I'll clean it up in a moment, so just bear with me here. Here is Weber's Higma as a function of R over R half for all the globular clusters that I have data for. Now, there is a ton of noise in here because I'm using clusters that have only 100 or so stars. So let me clean that up just a tiny bit. It's still a bit messy. And here we have all the clusters with 500 or more velocities. And there are 8 clusters here. And there are 2 aspects here that are obvious. The one is at large radii. Just a point that doesn't have to do with black holes is all clusters have rotation, and it's significant. It's of order what you get for elliptical galaxies. Weber's Higmas are 0.4 and 0.5 and higher. So all clusters rotate. You know, I learned 10 years ago in a grad school, the clusters don't rotate, but all of them do. But now you get an increase at small radii as well. Again, you have to be careful about noise, and I've been I've worried about that quite a bit. But if I look at the clusters that have the highest rotation, if I look at the central points there, they're quite extreme in terms of the signal is very high. It's at least a 3 sigma, sometimes a 4 sigma rotation measure. Just to show you the average rotation profile, then clear it looks like this. Now, it's no problem to get a rotation out there. Brainerd Spurzum has been working on this for a while, but the rotation in here is quite hard to get because in these clusters, two-body relaxation is extremely efficient. Any kind of a rotation signature that you see, you should be wiped out. You should transport that angular momentum out fairly quickly in the center in the high density regions of these clusters. So the fact that I see this increase here, I'm not going to explain it yet. But a black hole helps because what the black hole does is it lowers the two-body relaxation time because it takes away some of the mass you have to put into the high stellar density. You can put it into the black hole instead. Now, let's talk about black holes in M15. And I'm not willing to put the this number on there, but let me show you what the dispersion profile is doing in M15. So here is an old plot. This is a dispersion as a function of radius in M15, our highest density cluster. This line here is what I've gotten from my ground-based data, and this point here is the central 10 velocities. It's the dispersion for the central 10 points. These solid lines are black hole models where you assume isotropic distribution in orbits. And you assume constant M over L. I'll come back to that in a moment. And here you can see that the 2000 solar mass black hole model, it worked through, but you can also put that into stellar remnants. We know that stellar remnants are going to be in clusters, and they're going to fall towards the center as well. Our HST point now is probing from here in, and we have a point rate about, 0.008 on this plot, and it's about here. So it's about 15, and it has a fairly small error bar. But more than that, we have this shape of the dispersion profile that we are analyzing now. It is very, very tough to get a point that high with normal stellar population, with a collection of neutron stars and white dwarfs. You need too many of them in too small of a radius. You need a skewed IMF, a very top-heavy IMF. It's much, much easier to put a black hole in there. And the black hole that I like the best right now is about 2,500 solar masses. So just for fun, because we can do it, let's stick M15 on the plot. And lies down there. Its dispersion is around 11 or 12 in the middle, and it's close to the correlation. Now, this doesn't really mean... Now, I just want you to be aware. I'm putting a globular cluster on the same plot as galaxies. The formation mechanism may be extremely different. It's likely to be very different. So that's just a warning there that these may have nothing to do. Clusters may have nothing to do with galaxies. But I just put it on there because I don't know. I work in black holes. Now, M33 though has quite a low limit and even stands out as large chose in terms of its dark halo mass. Now, I have new observations that we got last month on the globular cluster G1 in M31, and that has a dispersion of about 20, and we're in the process of measuring that too, but that's going to be a tight limit for globular clusters as well. So there's some evidence there. Now, let's go to the very big. The very big galaxies are the hardest to measure. And let me show you why here in this plot here. Here is 4649. It is our largest galaxy, has the largest black hole mass that we've measured from stellar kinematics. Down here is a template of the calcium triplet region, and this point up here is the galaxy light. And that red line is this convolved with a 600 kilometer a second dispersion. You see, it's almost a flat line up here. Big galaxies are extremely expensive for three reasons. The one is that your dispersion gets completely wiped away. You just need extremely high Hamiltonian noise to pull it out. Two, the bigger galaxies have lower surface brightness, so it's hard to get information near the center. And three, they're very rare, so you have to go pretty far out. So it tends to be that the biggest galaxies are the farthest away. So you get killed if you try to measure resolved stellar kinematics in the big galaxies. You have to go to the other techniques, to the reverberation and to the photoionization techniques. And that has been done for a while. And just let me just to continue on and on what some of the stuff that Laura had talked about. And that's this plot here. So she showed the plot of Wandel and McClure and Dunlop, so where they plotted black hole mass. My axes are switched here because these are on two different papers. You plot black hole mass against either the luminosity of the bulge and the mass of the bulge. And you see a correlation, and Laura sees it as well, and it looks pretty good. And so these are measured by reverberation and photoionization models. So it gives us some confidence that the reverberation models are working, at least we can normalize them, and that the photoionization models are working as well. Now, what I would like to do is plot these things, not in terms of bulge luminosity. I'm a little concerned about the bulge luminosity being poorly estimated. These are AGN. AGN tend to live in young galaxies. Young galaxies tend to have young stars, and young stars tend to have high mass to light ratios, low mass to light ratios, and so that can possibly skew these masses. So what we want to do is try to apply the black hole sigma correlation to these galaxies as well. What I'm going to do then, and this, here's a sample that Greg Field and I have been working on, and we've taking radio quiet AGN in the literature. I'll talk about the radio loud in a moment. And what we've done is something very, very simple, is you can plot the mass of the black hole that you get from the H beta line just using an ionization model by Lior and McClure and Dunlop have outlined how to do that. And you can measure the sigma of the galaxy. You can use the O3 width as a surrogate for the sigma of the galaxy. People who do high redshift galaxy work do this all the time. What they use is they use an emission line, and you plot, and you simply plot, you know, the full width half max of the emission line. In quasars, the O3 and even more so the O2 line is likely not to be influenced much by the AGN region. You mainly are seeing galaxy from those lines. Charlie Nelson has worked on this quite a bit, and he does see that. He believes that the O3 lines are a good tracer of the galaxy mass, of the galaxy dispersion. Well, what's nice about this is you can use, then, quasars at any, you know, you can use quasars. It's easy to measure their O3 line width, easy to measure the H beta width, and you can put them on the correlation. Here is all the samples that we've taken. Now these quasars in AGN, they range from nearby out to a Z of 3.5. So what we're beginning to try to do here is to look at the evolutionary history of the black hole sigma correlation, or the growth history of the galaxy, or the growth history of the black hole mass. And this line here is not a fit. So this line here is the local black hole sigma correlation that I just have been showing you. And what you see here is this normalization is not put in there. It was not a fit. These points are generally fit to the photoionization models are generally calibrated by using the reverberation techniques. So what I would like to do is plot this as a function of redshift and see if we can see anything there. And what I want to plot is the offset of the black hole sigma correlation as a function of z. If you want to argue, as some of the theories do, that when to cause a correlation between black hole and the mass of the galaxy, you have to have the black hole first or the galaxy first, That's going to cause an evolutionary effect in this property. So here is the offset from the black hole and this HEGMA in the gap. The black hole as measured from the H beta and the black hole as measured from the black hole sigma correlation as a function of redshift. And we're out to 3.2 or 3.3 out here. And we see no offset. Now, if you wanted to say that galaxies came first and then you grow the black hole later on through subsequent emerging and such, then what you would notice would be a scatter like that. If you wanted to say the black hole came first and the galaxy formed around it, later on you would have a scatter such as like that. We see no such a difference. Now, there are large assumptions that are going into here. The assumptions are the photoionization models are good. The other assumption is that the photoionization models are working at all magnitude range, at all black hole masses, that the ones that have been, that the small mass black holes where the photoionization models have generally been calibrated, which is, this is where most of the photoionization models have been calibrated, apply up here as well. So that's an assumption as well. So part of the goal is you want to measure a variety of luminosities at a given redshift. And back to this plot here. Again, what I want to stress is that the zero point here is not normalized. It does have a meaning. What the first thing you can notice here is that the scatter actually at small redshift is larger than the scatter at high redshift. That is most likely a collection effect. Down here we are choosing, there are a lot of narrow lines, Hilbert galaxies that have gone into here. And so the scatter, I'm concerned, is biased by that. So this is a radio quiet AGN. We've also included radio loud AGN as well. There's another 20 or 30 radio loud AGN. And the scatter is larger when you include the radio loud sample, but not significantly. You would still come to the same basic conclusions about the offset of the correlation. Okay, so we think we might be able to find an evolutionary, this might be a path to find the evolutionary history of how the galaxy grows in relationship to how the black hole grows. The other way to do that is to use the orbits. And let me just quickly put that plot up there. As I said, in these models, we get an idea of the of the stellar orbital structure. You don't just measure the black hole mass, but you get how the stars are moving in the galaxy. And so I'm going to plot now, I'm going to come back to local galaxies now, and plot the internal structure of the galaxy. And what we're looking at here is, since we have these general models, these fully general models, what we have is what all the stars are doing in terms of their radial, tangential, and phi motions. So we can look at their internal structure. I am plotting the radial motion to the tangential motion as a function of the slope of the central slope of the galaxy. And each galaxy is being plotted twice in this plot. So here, the solid blue symbols, I'm plotting that at the very central region. This is inside the sphere of influence of the black hole. And the open symbols, I'm plotting at the half-light radius of the galaxy, so quite far away from the black hole, not influenced by the black hole. What you notice here is a trend for the galaxies that become flatter in their profiles. So these are the more massive galaxies. The ones that become flatter in their profile tend to become more tangential in the central regions. So this is one of our first peeks into what the stars are doing inside of a galaxy. What it tells us is information about the history of the black hole growth as well. And so what it suggests, and there's only been a very few models so far that have modeled black holes inside of galaxies and how they affect the stars, but what it suggests is that the only way to get tangential motion, well, the easiest way to get tangential motion is to have stars on radial orbits come close to the black hole. They're either accreted or ejected. So it's a natural way to lose stars on radial orbits. And then you're left with tangential orbit. So it's natural to have the galaxies that have the biggest black holes to have some tangential anisotropy. The amount of tangential anisotropy is what's surprising. Most of the models that have done those calculations of seeing what you get only imply small tangential. If you look at the adiabatic growth models, they only imply values up around a beta of minus 0.3 and lower and smaller. It's very tough to get anisotropies that high. A way to do it is to have a binary black hole, is to have the influence of a binary black hole. If you have two galaxies that each have black holes and they merge, the black holes are going to come together, and those black holes, just because of the momentum, are going to wander around in the core, and they'll be able to affect more stars on radial orbits and eject or accrete those stars on radial orbits. So it's natural if you have a binary black hole model to have this much tangential anisotropy. So the point is now, and let me put up the prospects here, the point is we have ways to get the evolution of the galaxy and the evolution of the black hole. The one is by the mass, is by trying to study the mass curve, but the other way is by trying to look at the orbital structure and to see how that relates. So let me just stick up the prospects of what we're going to have in the future. In about a year, we'll have another 50 black hole measurements from spatial loop result kinematics, either from stars or from gas. We'll have many galaxies with multiple techniques. 4258 is the golden child for black hole masses. It's the standard. It has a major mass that is just anchored. We now have stellar kinematics on it and gas kinematics on 4258. It'll be a very nice galaxy to test biases in either the stars or in the gas. The problem is there are at least three galaxies now that have gas masses that are lower than what you get from stars. And you'll get the high and the low mass end for stellar kinematics, and we'll begin to check for other parameter effects, such as environment, to see if that has an effect. For globular clusters, we'll have these M15 results out very soon, in a couple of weeks. G1 and M31, we just got these in, and we'll have that up fairly soon too. So we have all this crown-based velocities, and we have all the HST imaging. We'll be able to get a very good census of what the typical globular cluster looks like, and that's coming. But again, as I point out here, the major obstacle is understanding the role of stellar remnants in this, and that's going to be a big obstacle, is my bet. For quasars, it's easy to obtain these large sample of black hole masses in AGN, as I say. Now, there are a lot of systematics you need to work out, but it's easy to get those masses. And once we get those, we can calibrate these reverberation and photoionization techniques. Not only do you get black hole masses, but you get constraints on AGN physics. So hopefully, we'll be able to have about 10,000 or how many quasars that's Lone and 2DF want to come out with, and we'll have these over a range of redshifts. So I'll end there. Thanks. So this plot here.
What I think is actually going on, and let me say that I actually you know, those series of models that you put up, I don't think that resolving the difference between 4.5 and 3.9 is going to help any of those models. I don't think they make the difference to that level of accuracy. But even if they do, I think what is going on here, you're not plotting errors on the signal. But the three galaxy at the lower, level. One of them is the Milky Way. Now, for the Milky Way, the velocity dispersion that you plot there is not measured on the
I'll find, just give me a, okay, go ahead, I'll find my plot in a moment.
Right. So the velocity is pretty good to wait time to support the sensor. Take a value simpler than
right, okay, here's the dispersion profile for the Milky Way. If you choose RE over 8 for the Milky Way, you have to choose about 65 or 70.
For the velocity dispersion, but then you have the component of the circular velocity too.
No. This is out of a paper from Gerhard and Genzel and Ott. And their circular velocity of the bulge for the Milky Way at about RE over 8, if you do the integrated RE over 8, you should get about 65 or 70.
I completely disagree with that. I think that I think 120 is better estimate. But anyway, you will agree on one thing, that it's a very uncertain value.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So if you do put errors on that plot, that Milky Way change is pretty much anchoring your relation at the low end. We play absolutely no way. The other galaxy, which is 7457, has a black hole sphere of influence, which is undersampled by a factor of 10. So as I said, I haven't seen the analysis published for these galaxies, but I find it hard to believe that you can pinpoint them as to that accuracy. It's practically the same accuracy for M87 or something. When you know your 0.1 slip is a factor of 10 larger than the black hole sphere of influence. So if you take those two points out, and that's what's anchoring your relation there, I think you obtain, which is what we do, a much steeper relation.
It makes, if we take these two points out, it makes no difference in the slope of the correlation. And if we use your dispersion for, if you put Milky Way here, it's the same value as well. It's these points here that are driving the correlation,
okay,
the
so
slope
I'm
of the correlation.
That I did the same analysis with the same point and the slope of C5. Maybe it's because we use errors in both coordinates, which I think we should do. If you don't use errors in any coordinate.
Yeah, we use errors in bulk in this plot. Now, just so this is an excellent example, and I explain this to my intro astronomy 101 class. If you give two scientists the same data, they don't get the same answer.
I don't agree. I mean, then one of them is really mistaken. So anyway, I don't.
We'll
split the variables. The other question I had. Do you remember what the ratio between the orbits or the number of orbits to the number of constraints is for your dynamical model?
It's close to 1:1 because you have to find the orbits that many orbits have zero weight. So the orbits that have weight are 1:1, but you have to run many more orbits to cover the phase space properly.
If you seriously don't see it, well, the black holes have to grow by a certain amount during the quasar epoch. You know, if you use the argument, resultant type argument, quasar light is something like 30% given the current estimates of the global.
If not more.
If not more.
Yes.
And so if you really don't see a correlation of this relation with redshift, what it suggests is that your detectability of black holes in AGN is biased towards the latter part of the growth phase when it's done.
Yes, exactly. I agree completely. Yes. So it's a perfect point. It's tough to use this black hole offset as a function of redshift. Yeah, we want to do a few things. We really want to explore lower luminosity at high redshift, but those are the toughest ones to do. But that's the natural way to go.
How concerned should we be about using the oxygen-free why we're to trace the history of the host galaxies, because as you go to higher redshifts, you're going to have more mergers and interactions.
Right. People who do these huge redshift surveys have been struggling with this for a while, O2 and O3. I've tested this on many nearby galaxies that are active galaxies, star-forming galaxies. I've tested them on star-forming galaxies, galaxies I believe to be the analogs of the high redshift, but there's the problem is the ones I believe to be the analogs. It's a question which you always have to ask yourself. So that is an issue.